Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star one on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the question queue. You may press star two if you'd like to remove your question from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. Our first question is from Tony King of Houston, Texas. Please go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I'm so glad you got to do a piece on pediatrics. We also have one that's accredited in Houston, Texas. It's Texas Children's. And so we do a lot of collaboration with them. I just wanted to comment, I'm glad they finally came out with a criteria for pediatrics for MS because they did not have that for a long time. Mm-hmm. And how do you give the kids the keep smiling, some of the paperwork that's handed out by the MS Society that kind of helps kids understand about MS?
Absolutely. There's several resources that National MS Society, in collaboration with the MS Society of Canada, have developed several resources. And I certainly, when I first started practicing in pediatric MS, there was absolutely nothing. That was 13 years ago. And since
right.
that time, it's just blossomed of what they've offered. So we certainly give out, there's the Mighty Special Kids booklet that's for the school-age children, sort of 6 to 12 years of age. There's also Kids Get MS 2 Guide for parents.
Yes.
Which is a great, it probably needs to be updated a little bit, but a lot of the information is still very relevant. They've also developed a Students with MS and Academic Setting Handbook for school personnel, as well as a guide mm-hmm. for parents dealing with the schools. They've got email support groups. They've got parent teleconferences, just like we're doing right now, where they'll have a guest speaker. Families can call in. And so they call it the Children and Teens with MS Network for Families. And these are all the resources that they offer. And they also, I've noticed recently, they have their MS Learn Online has a pediatric MS series where there's a few videos presenting about MS for patients and families, and it interviews not only healthcare professionals but also the parents and I think one or two teens as well. So
oh.
there's some great resources out there.
Yeah, and I wanted to just, sorry, I have two questions. I'm hogging your time. What about the parents that won't leave? We've had some that got bridged over, and even though they're 20 or 21, will suggest, like, why don't we ask you a few questions, or why don't we have mom wait out here and mom will insist on coming in? How do you kind of handle that?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question.
Yes. So, I mean, that can always be a challenge. I mean, we actually try to introduce at a fairly young age that there needs to be at least a bit of private time. And then once they're 18, you need to ask the young adult for permission to have their parents be part of that interview. So, some of the kids are used to that, and they're happy to have their parents part of that. But we always make sure that there's some private time. So we will introduce it. We'll say once they're sort of, if we've been following them, say, since they're 9 or 10, once they turn to, 14 or so, we always say we do want a little bit of private time to talk to their kids. And obviously we get the teenagers' permission as well. And often we'll say we'll do the physical exam without the parents present. And then during the exam, we can ask some questions as well. So we just sort of say that's the way we do it in the clinic. And so they get used to that.
Uh-huh.
And certainly transition is a big issue in preparing the teens to transition to the adult care providers. And I think it may be more challenging if the adult care providers are starting at the young age, and things may
right.
not necessarily transition over as easily when you're dealing with completely different professionals. So,
right. Well, for us, we've had the pediatric physician, the MS doctor, Dr. Lotsey, come over with a nurse, and we actually have our physician and myself, and so all four of us go in, meet, and the nurses and I kind of step out so that way it's not overcrowded and they don't feel like they're being watched.
Right.
But so there's kind of like that bridge, and there's a continuity.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if it's good or bad, but it seems to have helped kind of ease.
I think it makes a big difference. That's a great strategy to really help with that transition. Then I think they sort of feel too that there has been a good transition of information, because sometimes if they go there, they're there with a familiar person, and then they meet with someone that's new, and to know that you know the person they're familiar with sort of supports this and is giving the information,
right,
that they trust this person to take on your care. And often it's the teens that do okay. It's the parents are more struggle with a little more. So,
yes, I feel that we have the same thing.
Yes, yeah. So I think parents get so attached to the care providers, and whereas I think teens are a little more, they're at that age where they go more with the flow. They're used to changes in their lives, whether they're going off to college or heading off into the work field, and they're sort of expecting change in their lives, and so they adapt. Where I think parents sometimes struggle a little bit more with an environment that's maybe less accepting of their amount of involvement can be difficult.
Right. Thank you so much for that. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Thank you, Tony. We really appreciate your input. Let's go on to the next question in the queue. Manny?
Yes, thank you. Our next question is from Patricia Pagnotta of Orlando. Please go ahead.
Jen, thank you so much for your presentation. I actually just removed my question because it was kind of answered, but I really enjoyed your presentation. It was wonderful. So thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. If I ramble on long enough, your question will be answered, right?
Yeah, it was a great presentation. So that's all I have to say.
Okay.
Okay, well, Manny, I guess we'll go to the next question in the queue.
Certainly, and as a reminder, everyone, it is *1 to ask a question. And the next question is from Jennifer Smirko from Boca Raton, Florida. Please go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
It's a great presentation. I really appreciate the information. I wanted to ask you specifically to go into a little bit deeper dive. I don't treat pediatric patients in my practice, but certainly have had the question posed to me when I've been out speaking to patient groups. And we can't generally speak to it because it's off-label, but how do you go about initiating DMTs? I mean, do you titrate? How do you train kids to inject themselves? And I was just curious if you could maybe go into a little bit deeper detail. I know it's on your slide set, but I think we have enough time to go through that.
Sure. So it's always important from the beginning to involve, I would say before you even sort of get into the actual treatment, is to spend some time with the kids and their parents about what the options are, and saying it's sort of important for them to be part of the decision, because they're more likely to adhere to the treatment if they are part of the decision rather than the parents making the decision for them. And I also, I always say, you know, make that first injection a positive experience, and that's sometimes easier said than done. Certainly, if there's different ways you can do to make them feel more comfortable about it, to give them a bit of control over the situation, that kind of thing. And as far as self-injection, you've asked about, I find that the younger kids, they really vary. Some, you know, sometimes we get older teens that really don't want to self-inject, and others are quite keen. So it's just a matter, if they're younger, we often talk about the parents doing it initially. And then as the kids get more used to it, and usually it's as they mature where they want to go away for a week without their parents, or they, you know, they're going away to camp, they're going away to even for sleepovers, that kind of thing, that they want a little more independence. So sometimes kids initially their parents will do the treatment, and then you know, a couple of years down the road, they sort of indicate that they want to learn how to do it themselves, and so I bring them in and do some more teaching then. So that's all sort of part of that re-education piece. You also asked about the dosing. We tend to start, kids actually tolerate the medications quite well. As far as side effects, I really don't think they have any more side effects than adults, and maybe even are less bothered by it. I think particularly with the interferons, where they they tend to be quite deep sleepers. So we often say, you know, take your injection in the evening, and they fall asleep, and they are getting into a really deep sleep, and they don't tend to wake up in the middle of the night and be bothered by some of the symptoms. So overall, I think they seem to tolerate things just a little bit better. And we're maybe a little more conservative as far as how quickly we titrate up. Now, teenagers, we tend to follow the same as adults. Younger kids, we just watch, especially with the interferons, we watch their liver functions very closely. And you know, we may not increase from, we'll start maybe half dose and then increase to a full dose after maybe a couple of months and then see how they do from there. We've had kids as young as 7 be on full dose. So
wow.
They actually can tolerate quite well. They metabolize things actually sometimes better than adults do. So, you know, it's not necessarily equivalent as far as size, that kind of thing. So they just metabolize things very differently.
And also, Jen, I wanted to ask two more pieces to that. Is
mm-hmm.
One, do you use all of the medications that are available currently?
Mm-hmm. So we certainly use all of the interferons and the glatiramer acetate, and we're certainly natalizumab is used by quite a few centers. Now, I don't know how, we certainly haven't started using some of the oral medications yet, though I imagine that will come down the pipeline. Once again, I think sometimes because there's no treatment trials in children, we need to sort of first of all see how the adults do and iron things out as far as actually in the real world treatment, and then gradually we'll start to probably add that to the repertoire as far as children are concerned. But overall, we do use most of the treatment options.
Okay,
Jen,
so
to add to Jen Smirka's question, how about the use of the auto injectors? Do you find that that's used pretty prevalently in children or not?
In the majority, we will use auto injectors, but I've often found that, when I first sort of learned about the treatments with MS, and I thought, oh, the auto injectors would be great for the kids, but I find the kids under about age 12 do not like the sound of the auto injectors. They're actually quite frightened by them, and we've had some kids, because we've started them on the auto injectors and they're so frightened by them that they never, ever feel comfortable using them, so that can sort of limit sometimes self-injection in the future because they're so afraid to start using the auto injector. So I often suggest to parents that this, you know, we can see how the child responds to the sound of it. So that's where it's good to have some demonstration. I use a little teaching doll, and we practice on the teaching doll so they get an idea of what the sound is like. And if they seem quite frightened by it, then we sort of talk more about manual injection. The exception is, now I understand in the States that you haven't got the RebaSmart device yet, but we've had success with it. Because my understanding is the prototype for that was actually a device used to give growth hormone injections to children. So it actually was developed for children to begin with. And so many of the kids seem to be able to tolerate that. So, but every child's different. Some do fine with the auto-injectors, and others just don't like them at all. So, but I always sort of try to warn parents that as much as it might seem simpler for them to give the injections using the auto-injector, it just may make the whole experience a lot worse for their child.
Well, you're right. We don't have the RebiSmart. It's not FDA approved here, but with the approval of the Avonex pen, do you find that, you know, that they find that easier to use with children?
Yes, I mean, some of them really really do like using the pen, but others are still that click that they don't like. So, but overall, I think it does, because it hides the syringe and the overall needle, and people sort of look at it almost like a, you know, an EpiPen kind of situation. People seem to be able to relate to that. So so sometimes that makes it a little more tolerable, and they will agree to it. So.
Well, thank you, Jennifer. I just wanted to tell you again, I appreciate all of your hard work for this, but I'm going to get off the line so some other people can ask questions. And as I do that, I just wanted to have one last follow-up question to the drugs as well, was are you guys doing any of the kind of the newcomers? Like, are there aren't any clinical trials. You said, obviously, testing children, but have you guys used anything, or do you know if any of the other pediatric centers have used things like rituximab or CAMPATH or any of the kind of things that are coming down the pike potentially in the adult population?
Well, we have used rituximab, but also we have, I think some of the greater comfort level with that is that we have rheumatologists that use it. And so we actually work closely when we're dealing with rituximab is to deal with our rheumatologists. So they, so there's a little bit of a precedence as far as use in the pediatric population. So we certainly will use rituximab. And I said we have been starting to use Tysabri, and I said certainly some of the newer fingolimod and things like that. I think we probably will in the near future, but I think initially I think the pediatric professionals tend to be a little more conservative when there haven't been drug trials, just to make sure that we're not putting kids at risk until we sort of fully understand how adults respond.
Thanks so much, Jen.
Thanks, Jen. Thanks for your question. So let's move on to the next question. Manny, is there anybody else in queue?
Yes, we just got Tony King from Houston again. Please go ahead.
Okay, Tony.
Hey, I was just wondering, what about, because of our population, we have some Hispanic, and I was wondering about intimacy, because once they get that diagnosed, they think that they need to start having a family right away because they feel that that's kind of it for them.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have the intimacy talk with them or that discussion?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly do talk about, obviously we talk about about birth control and about, we ask them about their relationships. Do they have boyfriends and girlfriends? And actually, the people who tend to ask more about the future and ability to have children tends to be the parents or the young adults. It's quite actually interesting that when teens are diagnosed, so the parents will be asking, will there be any problem with my child having children? So I find that quite interesting. We haven't come across too many. I know we did have one teen that was sort of wondering about, if I'm going to have kids, I want to have them earlier because when I'm older, I may not be able to look after children, that kind of thing. So
right.
We've had one or two of them that have sort of talked about that kind of thing. And we certainly have had, 17, 18-year-olds that have had children, obviously, but unplanned. I don't think they were necessarily planning to have children at a young age because they wanted to do this sooner rather than later. I think they were both unplanned,
right.
But certainly we do talk about birth control. We do talk about relationships and how this may affect them, that kind of thing.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Tony. I do have a question for you. As far as disclosure, do you find that maybe the parents would like to disclose and the children don't want it disclosed or vice versa?
I would say the parents tend to be a little more open. Well, it varies, but I would say in general, the parents are more willing to be open about who knows their child has MS. And I think sometimes they're seeking support as well. I think sometimes they're thinking that, these people will sort of help my child, and it's important to rally these people around them. Whereas we do have some, especially our teenagers, they often don't want anybody to know. Though it's interesting, when we did our study, a lot of the kids said, my friends, my close friends know. I let my coach know. Sometimes they let their employer know, and they've had some accommodations for them, that kind of thing. So overall, they seem to sort of recognize the teens anyways, who are the important people to tell. But parents need a little more guidance sometimes on knowing, you don't necessarily need to tell everybody that you come across that, my son or daughter has been diagnosed with MS. It's because sometimes kids can resent that.
Mm-hmm. I could see that. So actually, how about if we ask the audience a question right now? In our audience, is there anybody who, if you're at MS centers and see quite a bit of MS patients, have you had any consults for children or for kids? I know when we had first started out, you know, 10, 12 years ago, the youngest child that we had in our clinic was 12. And, of course, then we refer them if we see them first. And we're an adult practice, so we don't typically see children. But then we would refer them to one of the larger centers, you know, in Houston or in Dallas. So I guess I would like to see if anybody in our audience, so Manny, if you could take a poll again, if anybody has done children consults for MS.
Certainly. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question or respond, please press star 1 now on your telephone keypad.
And while we're waiting for that, I know you've worked with MS children for how long? It's been quite a while.
13 years, yeah.
For 13 years. So you've probably seen a lot of changes all along that way as far as the resources and things that are available for the children and for the teens.
Yeah, I mean, certainly over the years, the MS societies have really worked hard, and not just the National MS Society, the MS Society in Canada, but certainly in the UK, several of the European countries have developed more pediatric resources. So they're really trying to, and obviously with the internet and Facebook and things like that, that there's really ways to connect. And I think one of the greatest things that's been developed in North America are the camps. The Stony Brook New York Center created a teen adventure camp a number of years ago, and have offered this every summer for probably 7 or 8 years now, a four-day camp in Rhode Island, and also the MS Society of Canada for the last 5 years has had a one-week camp. And it's just a great way for these kids to get together, to meet other, I mean, often they don't know anybody else in their community that has MS, and for them to be able to meet in a fun atmosphere. Other kids who have MS and how they cope with it, and it's no big deal that they all get, you know, it's time for their injections, and they you know, and certainly in the camp that we have, there's like this health hut, and they all sort of wander off to the health hut, get their injections, and their buddy comes along, even if it's not their day to have their injection, they'll come support each other, and then off they'll go and do something else. So it's just wonderful to see, and then they stay connected on Facebook, and it's just a fabulous way for them to feel like they're not alone.
That's great, because I think the camps are great for the kids to be able to get together with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
So, and these camps are free.
Yes, they are.
Maybe
yeah.
through that MS Society or
yep.
whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as one of the other things that I wanted to talk about or ask you about is teaching the school personnel.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that challenging as far as, you know, dealing having them understand MS and understand what the patient
mm-hmm.
is actually dealing with
mm-hmm.
as far as the symptoms and things like the fatigue. I can imagine it might be kind of difficult if for somebody, for PE, for instance, you know, even though it's 100 degrees down here, you know, our high schoolers, they're still running around the track in that 100 degrees weather.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, for them to be very understanding about how that affects, you know, an MS patient.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's where it's really important. And as I said at the beginning, that I do tend to, when they're diagnosed, I'll say, would you like a letter for the school? And I outline the symptoms of MS, and I stress the issues about fatigue, about heat sensitivity, and that there may need to be adaptations to or accommodations to their physical education programs. But also, I always stress too that these kids also need to sort of figure out what their limitations are too, that they really are, it's not, we don't want them to stop doing things just because they have MS. We
right,
try to encourage
right.
them to do what activities they feel they can do, but for the teachers to recognize that sometimes these kids fatigue very easily, they are very bothered by heat, they may need some added support or accommodation so that they can still participate, but maybe in a modified way. So I find it's really important to have written communication so that, because especially in high school, they don't just have one teacher. They have several teachers, and having a way that that can all be communicated to each one of those teachers. And it may mean being identified as a student with special needs, and so that, you know, the teachers can get the added supports they might need to support the young person in the classroom. So so sometimes that's where they do need to is support for families to share with the school if there are special needs, or even and recognizing, too, the unpredictability of MS, that one day they may be perfectly fine, and the next day they've got a leg weakness, or they've got an optic neuritis and they can't see. And so therefore, if they've got a right optic neuritis, they need to be on the right side of the classroom, or otherwise they really can't see the board, that kind of thing. So.
I could see where those adaptations, they would have to be very, very understanding of that.
Yeah.
So,
is there more? Schools are often more comfortable with dealing with kids who have more permanent disabilities because it's fixed.
I imagine you're right. You know,
yeah.
In so many cases, they probably think the child is lazy.
Yes.
You know,
mm-hmm.
or unmotivated, and it has mm-hmm. nothing to do with that at
yeah.
all.
Yeah.
And
so you just need to sleep more. You haven't been going to bed early enough. You need to
right.
go to bed earlier, right. and then you won't be falling asleep in my classroom. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure those are issues you deal with a lot. Let's check in the queue one more time, Manny. We have time for one more question.
Sure. We have another question from the line of Jen Smirka from Boca Raton. Please go ahead.
Hi, Jen and Lori again. Sorry, I just wanted to ask you, kind of expounding on the resources for the kids. I would imagine you guys have probably spent a lot of time with the parents as well, right? Because, I mean, being a new parent myself, just imagining having a child that was diagnosed with a chronic illness, how much time you guys spend in counseling and trying to, give coping resources or coping mechanisms to parents? Because I would imagine the child would model their parents' reaction to some extent, no?
Yes, absolutely. We often call that contagion theory, where how the emotional contagion theory, where a parent may have a certain emotion and it is passed on. So if a parent seems very anxious or worried about something, that will make the child very worried. So that's where it is so important to do a lot of education and counseling. And often what we'll do in our clinic is the neurologist obviously needs to be the one that confirms the diagnosis. And then often they'll ask me to come in and spend more time with the family. And even though the neurologist may have answered a lot of questions and spent a lot of time with them, I'll spend quite a bit more time with them reviewing everything, and I always make sure that they, have my contact information, that they can contact me if they have any questions, are worried about something, and I often talk too about using the internet, and if there's anything that they look on at the internet and they're wondering, does that apply to me or my child, to always contact us to sort of debunk some of the myths about what's out there on the internet. So you really do need to spend a lot of time, especially in the beginning, teaching and supporting both the parents and the kids, and helping them cope with this chronic illness.
So, thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Jen. So are there specific websites that you recommend that the children, go to specifically for them?
I always direct to the major MS Society websites, and I do refer to the Young Persons with MS Network, and I usually suggest that is the best resource for them. So.
Okay.
Because otherwise, it's sometimes there've been some sites that've been there temporarily that people create, and then they're not sort of kept up to date. So I usually say that's the most reliable resource for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, listen, thank you so much. It was just very informative, and there's so many different factors that are involved in working with children with MS. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I would like to say goodnight on behalf of the IOMSN Town Hall Discussions. And I do want to thank Jennifer for her presentation again, and thank Novartis again for their support for these programs through an unrestricted grant. And I hope that you'll join us for next month. We will be having them on the second Monday. We're going to move them to the second Monday of the month. The itinerary will be posted on the website, and it also will be sent, you know, out in an email. In addition to that, I'd like to just remind you about the regional MS programs that are available. It's programs conducted actually throughout the country. It's a CME. It's free to attend for nurses. And if you go on the website, again, all the regional programs are listed, their times and their dates. So I would like to say thank you to everyone for joining us tonight, and thank you again, Jennifer, and good night, and we will talk to you all next month. Good night.
Good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude tonight's teleconference. You may disconnect your lines at this time. Thank you for your participation.